Hey, Trojan fans, it's time to get into the huddle with the Peristyle Podcast. The Peristyle Podcast is your weekly ticket to USC football and recruiting news. Don't forget, you can download the podcast 24/7 at our new website, peristylepodcast.com. And now, here's the host of the Peristyle Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher, Ryan Abraham.
Hello, Trojan fans, and welcome to episode number 198 of the Peristyle Podcast. We've got a great show for you this week on the podcast. We're going to talk a little BCS. We've got some Heisman Trophy talk coming up. Later on today, we'll find out who the top Heisman finalists are, if Matt Barkley will be among them. We're going to talk to the Heisman pundit, Chris Houston, from New York City, actually, talking to him about what he thinks about the Heisman Trophy this year. I'll reveal what I voted. I'm an official Heisman voter this year, so you can hear who I voted for. And we have Dan Weber in the first segment. We're going to have a lot of USC questions to get to, finishing off the season, so we're going to talk to him. And then same thing like we did the last couple of weeks, we will do a Trojan Blast recruiting podcast tomorrow on Tuesday. So we'll have Gerard Martinez talking about that. Harvey Hyde this week is on secret assignment, but we do have a lot of questions to get to, and Dan Weber is going to do a great job of getting to all those for you. If you have any questions or comments for us, we'd love to hear from you. Podcast@uscfootball.com is our email address, or you can give us a call. 206-888-6755 is the number. And wanted to thank Dan Weber again for coming on and batting leadoff for us. What's up, Dan? How you doing?
Doing good. Looking forward to going first here.
Yeah, for sure. We do have a lot of questions, but just before we get into all that, we were talking before the show about the BCS. We did have some people writing in about, don't you have to win your conference to represent the BCS, the national championship game? And there's been some misconceptions out there, but I think we both agree it's not the greatest bowl lineup going on.
No, it's really not. I mean, we were thinking it, and I don't know that it's just West Coast bias or whatever, but right now, I mean, the only two games I'm interested in, I think the Rose Bowl is a good game. I think Wisconsin's always a good Big Ten team to come out here. They've got, interesting quarterback, Monty Ball, then the running back. They've got great fans, and maybe Oregon will be ready to, step up and follow the, I think the last time they won a big game was 1917 in the Rose Bowl. So they're about due. So it might be interesting to see that game. I think that'll be one I'll be watching. And I like to see if Stanford, gets healthy enough, and there's Stanford and Oklahoma State in the Fiesta Bowl. I was impressed with Oklahoma State. I know Oklahoma obviously didn't want to play anymore and just wanted to go home. But I thought Oklahoma State actually played themselves into the championship game, and I think it's an unbelievable embarrassment for BCS that they went with the rematch of Alabama LSU, it's the dream that the SEC had ever since they set up the BCS, and then they figured out how to game it. But nobody, I don't think, ever thought that they would double game it and get two teams that couldn't score a touchdown against one another because their offenses are so bad and they have no quarterbacks. And then they talk about, they're geniuses. I mean, they have a league with no quarterbacks and they tell everybody how great their defense is. Well, maybe. I don't know. I saw West Virginia throw the ball for about 500 yards against LSU, and we saw, four turnover Oregon in their opener still scored 27 points against this LSU defense. It's just the greatest thing. And if you look at Alabama, you have no idea how good they are because they haven't played anybody. Who knows? I mean, their one road victory is, over Penn State by a couple of touchdowns. And, Penn State's not any good. And, they all say, well, Arkansas, look at Arkansas. Yeah, look at Arkansas. I mean, it's just, they pulled the wool over everybody's eyes. I think LSU's got some really good athletes. But could they play the pass? It surely looked like the Georgia kids were getting open time and time and time again, young kids at Georgia who weren't very talented and couldn't catch the ball, but they sure got open, they just didn't catch it. If LSU, as great as they are defensively, had been playing USC Saturday, I'm thinking the halftime score would have been about 28 to nothing. I mean, this is a team that had no first downs in the first half. And, you know, they get a, you know, punt return, you know, touchdown for, you know, a kid that doesn't cross the goal line with the ball and gets two amazingly right in the middle of the field blocks in the back on the return in order to get, you know, Tyler Matthews is really good. There's no question about it. And he may be have inserted himself into the five-man Heisman field. I don't know if you can do it that rate on the last weekend, but the unfortunate part there is if he does, and a couple of Heisman, you know, predictors that I saw, you know, the last two overnight, he would be maybe knocking Matt Barkley out of the five-man field. So we'll see, but right now, the SEC's got it going their way. Hopefully, the rest of the country says, gee, man, who needs this? I mean, if I'm the Pac-12 and the Big Ten, I say, do we really need to be part of this? Why don't we just go back to the old bowl system? You know, we'll play in the Rose Bowl, and we'll send guys around to other bowls, but who needs to be part of a supporting cast of a system that's basically been set up by the SEC to take care of the SEC? I really would seriously, you know, think about with another, I guess, another year. I guess they'll decide this coming year where the BCS goes. And I think 2014 maybe is the first year that they go the other way. They go with a new postseason setup. But if I'm the Big Ten and the Pac-12, I might think, you know what, who needs to be part of that? And let it be what it is, you know, a system that's been rigged for the SEC.
All right, Dan. Well, let's get to some of these questions. I agree with you on your BCS takes. We'll probably get a lot of time to talk about that during the offseason, too, leading up to the bowl season. But let's see. Steve had a question. He had a different take on the UCLA game, the 50-0 score. He felt that Kiffin went for records, and he didn't think it was sportsmanlike, and it was unbefitting of a coach of a top-caliber team. Don't get me wrong, I love the 50-0 shutout, but that was a 10-year-old part of me that enjoys a lopsided victory over an arch rival. What goes around comes around, and I'm afraid this will come back to bite us. What do you think about how Kiffin handled that game?
I don't know if you can, you know, approach those in terms of I'm afraid, you know, it's going to come back to bite us. I just don't think that's how you play a game. I also kind of agree with the way Pete always looked at it, Pete Carroll, that if you aren't trying hard and if you aren't doing what you do well, you really are demeaning your opponent. You're really, you know, taking, you know, you're taking pity on them. And I think there's nothing worse than that. You know, I thought, you know, for people who, you know, weren't crazy about Rick Neuheisel, so I thought he handled it really well. I thought he understood, you know, that you are saying good things about your rival if you play hard. I'm glad that Lane explained why they threw the ball to Robbie Bowyer. I think USC didn't want to, purposely had made the decision if they could get away with it, they weren't going to, you know, choose between Cody Kessler and Max Wittig, and so they weren't going to use either one's red shirt if they got lucky, and they didn't have to. And then with Jesse Scroggins got healthy, I think they kind of also decided, let's leave those three for the spring competition if that's, you know, if they are to be the successor, you know, depending on whether Matt comes back or not. So, and the game plan obviously was the way UCLA was playing defense. They were going to throw the ball. And they just decided, you know, we're going to just play as long as we're, you know, we're out there. We're going to keep playing. And that's how you do in a rivalry. And I think I would not agree with that. I thought UCLA handled it well. I thought they came off of it well. I thought they used it to their benefit in the Oregon game. I thought they came out, you know, and you know, I think that game wasn't terribly fair that Oregon had to be in that game, and it was hard for them to maybe be at their best. But I thought UCLA, you know, came off of it well, acquitted themselves well in the championship game where, you know, they really shouldn't have been there and knew it. And that was good for UCLA. I'm glad they, you know, they took advantage of it. But, no, I don't have that down, you know, that negative look about what UCLA or what USC did in the let's face it, it's the last game. I mean, this was USC's bowl game. They weren't going to get a play in the conference championship game, which again, unbelievably unfair that the NCAA did not rescind USC's bowl ban in the second year, especially after they knew what Paul D was involved in before the appeal was decided. And it's unbelievably, I think, short-sighted on the part of the Pac-12 not to have maybe changed their rule. They could have, if they wanted to, and they could have said, whoever wins the South is going to play in our first ever championship game. But they didn't. You know, Larry Scott didn't show the leadership, and probably was afraid the other 11 would say, no. We like it. You know, with USC down. And not in that game. Well, you got what you wanted then, a really bad game.
Right.
So USC basically knows this is all we've got. So for them to start taking a knee and all of that, I thought that would have been a bad form. I think they needed to play all the way through, and I'm glad they did.
Okay. We got some more BCS, USC kind of questions before we get into some other team stuff. We'll talk Mac Barkley, of course, but I guess real quick on this one. Lamar says on the media bias, what if USC joined the SEC? It would help recruiting, make the NCAA consider a plus one, get more support, and give USC a better chance to compete for the championship each year. What do you think about that?
Boy, that's interesting. My guess would be, the SEC would look at them differently. You'd see some flip-flopping big time if USC wanted to do that. That's an interesting thought. I hadn't thought about that. Then I think legitimately the SEC could say, you know, okay, whoever wins the SEC automatically wins it. That'd be interesting. The plus one model, I think, the SEC is thinking, I think, there is that they're going to be two of the four teams and they'll still have a chance to get there. I almost had the sense this year that these people aren't dumb people. They're running the SEC and they know their football. And I swear they know they're not sure what will happen in a championship game. A team that can really throw the ball like Oklahoma State, as bad as their defense is, the SEC people, I think, don't know what would happen if they had to play somebody who can really throw the ball. I mean, I think we've seen over the years what happens when a Big Ten team, even a good Big Ten team, comes to the Rose Bowl and they haven't seen anybody that can really throw the football. It's really almost impossible to get ready in a month for something you haven't seen all year, and it's why USC's had, you know, kind of an advantage, or the West Coast teams have had an advantage in the Rose Bowl. And I think that might be the same thing. And I think one of the reasons that the SEC so wanted this matchup is they didn't want one of those two teams to have to play in Oklahoma State, who just throws the ball all around the field, and they don't know how they do. So this is a good way to avoid that and not have to have that, you know, sense of, we haven't played anybody can throw it. Now we're going to play one. What's going to happen? We built this whole, you know, season around how great our defenses are, but what if we can't play somebody that throws the ball? So I think the SEC's, they're willing to take the criticism this year for the, you know, kind of bad offensive teams in the matchup, just based on we won't have to face somebody who can really throw the ball. But yeah, I think that's. I'd be very interested if USC, you know, said, maybe we'd like to play in the SEC. I would like to see USC I know they've signed the rights over for 12 years, but I still think they should keep exploring their options and making it clear that they're going to explore their options because they need to have, you know, some sense of, I don't get any sense that there's any gratitude from these teams who are going to get $20 million a year that they never would have gotten, you know, from TV revenue, basically generated by USC. I mean, I would guess of the $3 billion contract, easily, you know, $1.5 to $2 billion of that is generated by the presence of USC in this league. And the fact that they're all going to be able to go out and hire new coaches and what have you through nothing they've done. I mean, nothing. I mean, you know, Washington State's an absolute embarrassment as far as a big-time program. I mean, the stadium, the press box, they're just, in general, just awful. I mean, it's just, they should be, and, you know, they're out, you know, trying to, you know, they're out hiring a big-time coach, and they're doing it with USC's money. I mean, USC's underwriting, essentially, I think, all the new coaches in the league. I think at least they should be aware of that in the Pac-12, and they should say thank you every once in a while. Now, maybe USC needs to ask them, you know, in cases like the NCAA, for the Pac-12 support. And that's the difference. If you want to say, is there a difference between the SEC and the Pac-12? Yes. The SEC, they round up, you know, they circle the wagons, and they defend their own. You know, Auburn and Alabama may hate one another, but Alabama didn't say, to the NCAA, let's take Auburn down after last year. And that's not the same situation I don't think that you would find in the Pac-12. It just seemed like they didn't seem to care too much what happened to USC. I think USC needs to figure out a way to get the Pac-12 on their side a little bit. I mean, for example, Larry Scott on Friday night basically took a shot at USC like it was USC's fault that he didn't have a better game Friday night. You know, like, it was USC. They, you know, they were the rules breakers, and they had to serve their time, and da-da-da. You know, what a punk. I mean, really, that was a punky statement for him to make. And obviously he's defending himself because he's got such a horrible game on his hands. But I thought that was uncalled for, and I'm hoping somebody from USC called Larry Scott on that, because that was out of place. It was making USC, responsible for Larry not looking so good in that first championship game.
Yeah, I think he did a good job of on his own not looking so good. Yeah. Well, we got a couple of quick. Let's do a couple of quick BCS things. This is a great question. How does the BCS standings work? We don't really have time to get into all that, but he felt that the Pac-12 schools were being. It showed that there was a disadvantage over the SEC teams, but he was happy to see USC move up to the AP poll. And just so you know, Stanford was 4 in the AP poll, USC 5, and Oregon 6. But Tom Malloy in Orinda, California, I'm not sure where that is. I hope I pronounced that right. He said, how does the BCS rank schools when USC is on the schedule? This is a little more interesting. Does it hurt Oregon or Stanford? There seems one more way that the BCS and NCAA have no real interest in creating a fair and effective system of crowning a champion. Couldn't agree with you more, Tom, but maybe, Dan, just let them know how that works.
Well, Tom and I actually emailed. Tom, you know, has a real interest in this, and I basically, USC is ranked way underranked in the computers, and the, you know, the Arizona State game kills them. And as somebody noted on the P, essentially, human voters know that there was nothing to choose between USC and Stanford, for example, in that game. But in the computers, you know, they are not allowed to consider the, you know, where, you know, or they don't all consider very much where the game was played, or if it was an overtime game or what it was. They just consider that Stanford won that game. So USC is undervalued, I think, in the computers. But they are in all the computers, the 6 computers. So the Pac-12 teams that play USC get the same, ranking as Notre Dame would get for playing USC or whoever. I think the Pac-12 is hurting itself as Oklahoma State did. They played their ninth conference game, and the Big 12 or the SEC doesn't. And so you had, for example, because those teams in the Big 12 were playing one another last weekend, their conference took more losses over the weekend. The SEC didn't. The SEC only had one loss. So by the SEC, you know, basically playing the 8 conference game schedule as opposed to the 9 in the Pac-12, you know, I think that hurts the Pac-12 because they're guaranteed 6 more losses as a league. Whereas if you looked at that, you know, say 12th game played by the SEC, they could be 12-0 looking at the teams they play. And that's how they're gaming the system. They've figured out that, and they've limited the computers in ways that they can't count. They really don't take into consideration, I think, enough home or away or margin of victory or essentially how really bad some of those teams are that the SEC plays. That the SEC has just perfectly figured out a way to game the system. I mean, they start off the year with 7 or teams that are ranked. You know, Mississippi State, I still remember, first week of the season, we're watching LSU and Mississippi State. 2 ranked teams, Mississippi State. Man, this is the year they're really going to be good. They're terrible. And, you know, by the end of the year, everybody knows they're terrible. But when LSU beat them, they were a ranked team. I mean, Auburn, they're terrible. They're still ranked. I mean, they're still in the top 25. That's a joke. That's an absolute joke. So the SEC has taken the computers, figured out exactly how to game them, and then they tell everybody how great they are. And these, like, for example, they count the Harris poll. I mean, imagine. You look at the AP, and it took them all year, and those are actually guys working in the media who probably, to some extent, pay some attention. If you looked at the Harris pollsters, those guys, how are they're probably not paying the same level of attention, and you know it's easy for people to be swayed by by the SEC telling everybody how great they are. But you know, at least the AP got it right. It's amazing when you think that the Pac-12 ends up with the numbers 4, 5, and 6 teams in the country. That's almost that's truly amazing. This last week that happened.
It is pretty amazing. It's a testament to what some of the top teams of the Pac-12 are doing. We'll see. And then with some of the bottom teams, Dan, and this is leading to our next question, and I think this can really help the conference overall, but West wants to know, what do you think about the coaching changes or perspective changes at Arizona, Arizona State, UCLA, Washington State, as they relate to USC from a competition recruiting and conference strength perspective? You know, Leach and Rodriguez are already there. And then you got a couple other guys that'll be coming in pretty soon. I do think it's going to help overall in the conference that you get a guy like Mike Leach. I don't think you're going to see Washington State losing, you know, early out of conference games. And like you mentioned, that's where the SEC kind of takes, you know, they all win their early games, and then when you play each other, you're all ranked. And I think this can help in that kind of situation.
And as far as the new coaches in the Pac-12, I'm not sure, you know, how that. Because basically, what the SEC understands is you're only trying to produce 1 or 2 teams. If you know, having Mike Leach at Washington State makes that a really hard, you know, place to go play, or if he's taking a wide receiver and somebody else, you know, away from somebody, whether that's a net plus or not, you know, for the Pac-12, I don't know. You know, it could work the other way around. I mean, in terms of winning a national championship, we'll see. It is interesting. I think, you know, Lane does have a different approach to every game a little bit. I think Pete was so good on the big games because he let everything kind of take care of itself, and the big games just, you know, built themselves up, but that left you a little bit vulnerable for an Oregon State after an Ohio State, you know, something like that. That'll be interesting to see, but, I'm not sure having more good coaches in the Pac-12 will prepare a team to win the national championship. I think at least one of the things about the Pac-12 is you do see a diversity of attacks. You see more good quarterbacks. You see more good receivers. You see a little bit of everything. You know, you have an Oregon that plays one way and a Stanford that plays a completely other way. You don't see that in a lot of conferences where you have that kind of, you know, really a top five programs that are as different as you could possibly have them. So I think the Pac-12 always had an advantage there in a lot of ways. This will just make it tougher, I think. Is that a good thing or not? I don't know. I mean, the other thing was, because you were playing nine opponents as opposed to eight, especially when it was the old Pac-10, you had one more chance at getting upset. And probably that cost USC at least two national championships, you know, you know, that last game, that one other game that you played that, you know, somebody in the SEC didn't have to play or, you know, was the game. So I'm not convinced, you know, be good for the Pac-12, be good for watching. It might not be good for somebody getting through unscathed and getting to the championship game.
Okay. Thanks for that one, West. This was an interesting one from Art Martinez. It's kind of more of a statement. He wanted to send something. He's stationed overseas, and he wanted to send something to Matt Barkley, so I thought I'd read it on the show for him. He said, "Matt, I think you should make the best decision possible. You are an unselfish person and will go down as one of the greatest ever at USC, no matter when you leave. When I left the military, I had two options, take a job stateside with good money and never deploy, but travel to nice places, or spend 9 months out of the year in Afghanistan doing missions with conventional and special forces. I'm 26, about to be 27, and single. For me, it wasn't about the money. I took this job in Afghanistan because I wanted to do something special and never wanted to regret my decision. I never wanted to feel what could have been. For me, I needed this experience for the rest of my life. To be honest, my best mission was finding two IEDs before the convoy ran over them, not how many insurgents we've taken out. That's irrelevant. To me, it doesn't matter how many people we kill. What matters is how many fathers, brothers, and sons I can help bring home. That's special to me. You have to find what's special for you, and don't ever regret it. This is not a guilt trip. Our lives are totally different, and I wish no one live this life of mine. This is special to me. What's special to you? Good luck. Best wishes. I'm 100% behind any decision you make. Fight on, from Art Martinez." Kind of a nice letter there from Art there.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly the right way to approach it. You know, Matt doesn't owe it to USC. He doesn't owe it to us as media or the fans. I mean, yeah, sure. We look at it and say, yeah, USC becomes a bigger story and a hotter story if Matt's coming back. We know that. And USC, you know, would they be number one? I don't know. LSU, you know, they're going to tell us a thousand times how good LSU is coming back. But it sets up, you know, a wonderful storyline. And It makes it easier nationally for people to understand it. I mean, I was telling people last week, I think Matt Barkley got more coverage last week than Oregon, UCLA, the Pac-12 championship game, and Larry Scott all together. You know, just the potential of what's Matt Barkley going to do. So I think it underscores how that might work for next year and the storyline and how that would work, how that would play out. And I think it would set up such a natural Pac-12 USC versus the SEC matchup that we all, like, you know, think about, wow, that would be great if that happened. But I think the only way you can look at it is just the way
that was Art.
Art Martinez. The way he set it up, exactly correctly. All you can hope for is for Matt to make the exact right choice for himself, and I think he will.
Okay, well, thanks for that one, Art. And let's see, we've got Jerry. What happened to Victor Blackwell? Being such a highly touted recruit, he seemed to have dropped off the radar.
Well, he redshirted, and I thought he looked really good. You know, on the service team, I think he just he had a good day almost every day. He actually played better than I expected. I thought he had a really, really good redshirt freshman year. He showed a lot of days in practice. But you know what happens is you don't really report what the other than an occasional here or there, what happens with the service team much. You know, if they move some Vanuku to, middle linebacker a couple of different weeks or whatever, people might, we might talk about that. Or, a couple of the defensive linemen make a big play here or there. And, you mentioned, and Victor has had some, really good catches and things like that. But I thought he ran well, thought he caught the ball well, thought he played with a lot of heart and real enthusiasm. And but he redshirted, so you'll hear about him in the spring. But there is only room for one Marquise Lee on that. when you look at all the all the receivers, there just weren't enough throws to use up his redshirt year. There weren't enough spots. I mean, when you had they for a while they were trying to work in Marquise Ambles, and with the upperclassmen, that the Brandon Carswells and Kyle Prater trying to get time in there. There just really wasn't time for another freshman wide receiver.
Okay, thanks for that one, Jerry. Let's see. Mark has a question. In your story, Dan, when you quoted Matt Barkley after the UCLA game, says we have to take care of business with some players, unfortunately, but now that they're gone, this team is closer together. Was Matt referring to Dylan Baxter? I understand if you don't want to respond, but just kind of maybe get your comments on what Matt was trying to say there.
Well, I ran that by Christian Tupou and Ross Cumming, and their take on it was that everything that happened with this team, the team had input. That there was really a lot of communication, every day between the team and the coaches, and that the team would have had input on, situations like Marquise and Dylan. But Ross felt that he said, it clearly the decision was Coach Kiffin's, but we had. We were definitely involved in how we felt about it. That they were involved in. He said basically everything that happened this year, the players had a take on it. From how they were practicing to how they were if they were competing. That they, for example, with Pete, the competition was much more out in the open. They kind of kept it in house more. In terms of who would get the ice cream at the, Friday night at the hotel, that kind of thing, between the offense and defense and all that. They kept more things, I think, in-house, but they were very much involved in all those things. I think clearly that's what Matt was talking about, but that they were involved in that decision, but that the decision was Coach Kiffin's at the end.
Okay. Let's see. Let's move on. Thanks for that one, Mark. We have a couple questions from Jack in San Francisco. It's kind of, this is about scholarship stuff. Can USC convert athletic scholarships into non-athletic scholarships similar to Frankie Telfort and Matt Meyer's situation?
Yes. Yes, they can. They have to have a legitimate health reason, or they have to stop playing football. I mean, one or both. But they couldn't. They could not keep playing football and convert to scholarship. If they stay on scholarship and stay on the football team, it always remains as a countable football scholarship. So no, you can't convert them once they started out to receive financial aid as a football player. You can't convert them to anything else and still have them play football without being counted.
Okay, and then I think that probably answers that question, the second one. Does the 75-man roster only apply to players who appear in actual games? The NCAA made us forfeit games due to the appearance of an ineligible player. Could we have practice players who are on scholarship with zero chance of appearing in an actual game? Thanks, love the show. And that's Jack in San Francisco.
No. If they're getting aid, they count against the 75 scholarships.
Yeah. Yeah, we get a lot of questions about, well, what if it's like, no, all basically, right. If you play football, you're on scholarship. There's not really much you can do.
Yeah, I mean, I know somebody was creative and said, well, what if you take the four, you know, juniors who are going to the NFL either this year or next year and ask them to just, you know, pay their next year scholarship out of their NFL bonus or whatever. Not that those kids wouldn't do it even. And then that frees up four scholarships. No. The NCAA's figured that out. I mean, they understood what would happen at some schools. If you were allowed to do that, you know, they'd have 200 guys on scholarship one way or another. So there would be too many ways to get around that. So, they decided if you have ever had any football scholarship aid, you remain as a football scholarship, that counts forever as long as you're on the football team.
Yeah, you can't, like, go, oh, I'm going to walk up. Now, I think it's a little different when you have someone that was a walk-on given a scholarship. They can take that away, right? Do you understand it that way?
I don't think so. I'm not sure. That's a good question. That is a good question.
I think you didn't.
Then you get a scholarship. I think once you've gotten scholarship, then I don't think you can take that scholarship away and have them still play football. You can take the scholarship away, but they can't play football anymore.
That'll be interesting to see.
I think if they're forced, you know, they come down and now you got 77. You know, are you going to have to tell a couple of kids not only you know, that maybe you could stay on scholarship, but you can't stay on the team? I mean, I think they're going to definitely make it available so kids are not going to be left without scholarship aid, but they may only be able to keep their scholarships, and it'll be a different kind of scholarship, because obviously if USC has to go from 85 this year to 75 next year, they've got 10 scholarships already budgeted, you know, that they've got money for. What the NCAA is going to say is, yeah, you can keep them on some sort of scholarship. You just can't let them play football anymore. Now, these are kids, you know, that have busted their tail and wanted to be part of the football program and are out there practicing every day. And they may not be the, you know, the guys that are going to, win you the national championship on the field. But in practice, they might. And those kids might have to be told that, you know, you can't be on the football team anymore. And that's kind of a shame. And that's why the NCAA should never be allowed to penalize in terms of taking scholarships away from kids. That's why what the NCAA did, what Paul D did to USC, is essentially evil essentially against their stated mission of enhancing the student athlete's college experience. It's far from that, and it's an embarrassment for the NCAA, and that they don't even see that they don't understand how wrong that is, tells you all you need to know about those people, that they're so insulated in their, you know, bureaucracy and taking care of themselves that they, you know, don't pay any attention to the kids at all. And what it does, you know, to them, you know, is kids that have, most of them, you know, devoted their whole life to playing football, and for no reason of their own, no fault of their own, may get separated from the team, and that's wrong.
We'll get some clarification on that. It might be a rule where, because like a guy like Will Andrew, who got a scholarship this year, started off as a walk-on and then was given one. I think if you start off as a scholarship player, you could never come off of it. But I'm not sure. So we'll find out about that.
Because my sense is once you've been given a scholarship to play football, you count as a scholarship player forever as long as you play football. Now, if they would say we can't count you as a scholarship player because you throw us over 75, USC could keep him on scholarship, but they couldn't keep him on the team. That's from what I understand. And once they start as a scholarship player, they can never become anything else other than a scholarship player if they're still on the team. I mean, that's the sense is you might have to separate a kid from the team. The only reason is he's going to throw you over the 75 limit, and that would be kind of a shame.
It certainly would. Well, Jack has an interesting question on that, too. When does that 75-man roster have to be set? Fall? It's important for spring practice. And I believe it would be for, you know, after signing day. But when do you think it has to be set?
I think for fall. I think this year's numbers go all the way through this year. So I think it would be for next fall.
Okay, yeah, that would make sense. Let's see, we're almost out of time. We'll try to get through these quick. There's a couple left. Joe wants to know, is Andre Walker being groomed to take over for Khalil, or is there someone else the coaches are looking to play left tackle? And with two seniors leaving, what do you think the rotation is going to look like for next year?
Well, I personally don't see Andre as that guy who's out there blocking in space. I like what I see. I mean, he's aggressive, he's tough, he's physical. I think that's more of a footwork position, and I was lucky enough to actually even worked a little bit for the Cincinnati Bengals when Anthony Munoz played there, and I actually got to do some high school games with Anthony back in the Cincinnati area on radio, and he's always been my, you know, like the dream version of the, you know, left tackle with his footwork, you know, bringing in all the footwork that, you know, a baseball, having been a, you know, pitcher and first baseman. Anthony had this, you know, 6'7", 300-pound guy who had, you know, was so light on his feet and could move in space and maintain contact with those, you know, edge rushers and things like that. And I don't see that as Andre Walker's role. He's so big and strong and such a force. You see him more as a right tackle or for me, even more so as a guard. I don't know. I mean, one of the thoughts, and we were just kicking this around, is one of the guys who does really block well on the second level, and maybe, you know, on the first level, and the guy right on him, he's not the, you know, absolute greatest, but he really does have the ability to stay with people and take them out in the open field is Colin Holmes. Would he be a potential left tackle if you're going to get Markowitz back, Abe Markowitz? You've got John Martinez, who are both interchangeable with center guard. Would Khalid Holmes, who, again, the thing he does so well is cutting linebackers and getting, you know, maintaining, you know, taking down people, you know, downfield a little bit, would he be the most natural guy to move to that spot and make the changes internally? I don't know. But I think, you know, they're going to have to take a lot of different looks at that spot if Matt goes out of there. But I think that's one of the things I might look at. But I don't know that I'd look at Andre as the first guy out there. I think that would be asking an awful lot to, because you really often get isolated out there in that left tackle spot. You really, really better be able to maintain your quick feet and maintain contact with those guys. And that doesn't seem to be the number one strength of Andre. He's got a lot of them, and I think he's going to be a really good player. But I don't see him necessarily going there.
Okay, and then one last one, Dan. JJB wants to know what your gut feeling is. Well, the future of Armon Armstead.
I don't know. That's a good question. Lane, you know, I think he's kind of given us some clues. I almost did interpret what Lane told us, and I guess I was the one that asked him the question 2 weeks ago, that Armon, you almost got the sense that Armon could come back and play at USC. Now, Lane says he can't specifically go into medical details, and he can't, and USC doctors can't. I've always assumed that maybe there was a time frame that more than anything else governed his medical clearance. Again, we've heard other things. The way I've looked at it is there is a time frame. And the time frame will allow Armand to either, at that point, decide, I want to go. And this is what Lane tells you. So, I mean, either I can, at this point, I can go to the NFL, I can go to the combine, I can work out, and by the time the draft would be here, I'd be cleared. Or possibly, if that same time frame exists for the NFL, one would have to assume it might exist for USC as well. Could he come back? I mean, Lane said he could, but then he didn't say he could. He would be cleared. You know, it's kind of a conundrum. You know, it's so hard to know without knowing the absolute specifics of the case. You know, my hunch is, if he wanted to play at USC next year, I get the sense that he might be able to. But, you know, does he want to play in the NFL next year? I think he'd also be able to do that. He wasn't able to play this fall. That seems to tell me that the decision is time-related, time-sensitive, not so much related to the condition, because, you know, they certainly allowed him to go out and work very hard. In terms of his conditioning and his weightlifting and all of the other things, which would tell me it's not a heart issue. He told me, Armand told me, you know, that his primary care physician was not a cardiologist, that they had handed him off to the blood specialist. So, again, that tells me not a heart issue. My guess is a time frame issue. And if it's a time frame issue, the only thing that I could come up with that for an athlete with a time frame issue, and I told this to Armand, I didn't get an answer back, was that it sounds like a blood clot, and he listened. He didn't indicate it. And the problem with the blood clot is if they treat you with blood thinners, there are so few of those cases with someone who's playing football, a contact collision sport, which will cause you to get bruises, deep bruises, bruises that could bleed. And if you've been treated with blood thinner, then the question is, how long do you go before you're basically, your system is safe enough that you can, you know, start taking the bruising and the contact and the collisions that you take in football. You know, that's kind of the thing that I've always thought it was. Again, we certainly don't know that that's the case. And we're probably never going to know for sure that that's the case. But in that case, it's a time frame issue. And maybe, you know, I'll give you a really, you know, clear maybe for Armand. And that may be as good as we can come up with. It does look like there have been some communication issues between what Armand and his parents have been hearing and what the USC medical people have been saying. Again, I'm only guessing at that. You know, Gus has talked to us a little bit about it, and it's just kind of, it doesn't seem like they're talking always, or from what we can hear, from what we know is happening, that they're on exactly the same page in terms of what they're talking about, in terms of whether he could be cleared or not, or how he could be cleared. But I wouldn't completely write it off.
All right. Well, Dan, thanks very much for all your insights there and stepping in, batting lead off. We'll have Harvey Hyde on again next week, and it's been fun. We'll talk to you again next week, and I know you're going to the awards dinner tonight for USC football players, so we can get an update on that next week.
Thanks very much. Looking forward to it.
All right. Everyone else, back in 30 seconds, talking with Chris Houston, the Heisman pundit, about Matt Barkley's chances to win and go to New York for the Heisman ceremony.
Meet us on the other side of the break for more of the Peristyle Podcast. Tickets, tickets, tickets. SC Tickets is your concert, sports, and theater ticket source. We have the tickets you need to any event worldwide. Football tickets are now available. Call SC Tickets now at 1-800-888-7287. 1-800-888-7287. That's 1-800-888-7287. Or visit us on the web at sctickets.com. SC Tickets, concerts, sports, and theater. We now return to the Peristyle Podcast and your host, Ryan Abraham.
Welcome back to the Peristyle Podcast. We have a very special guest. We have Chris Houston, otherwise known as the Heisman Pundit. You can check him out on HeismanPundit.com. He is in New York, just landed in New York, actually, for the Heisman ceremony, which will be this Saturday, but coming up in a couple of hours at 3 o'clock Pacific time, 6 o'clock Eastern time, there should be an announcement of who the Heisman finalists will be. Chris is over there in New York. We're going to talk to him about all that. Chris, thanks for coming on. What's up?
Hey, Ryan. How's it going? Good to talk to a fellow Heisman Trophy voter.
I am. This is my first year, and I sent in my Heisman ballot over the Internet yesterday. When did you send yours in?
I sent mine in yesterday as well. So I think it was a little late in the afternoon. I was kind of struggling back and forth between one and two, and then I struggled back and forth between the third spot as well, but I finally got it done.
I did as well, and I mean, they do it by regions, and I think some of the West Coast people might vote a little differently than the South people and the Eastern people and all that kind of stuff. It was my first year doing it, and maybe I will reveal my Heisman ballot, maybe get your thoughts on that. I actually went for third place. I did RG3, Robert Griffin. He just really impressed me, and I thought he deserved to be in New York, and he'd be up in the ballot. He could even win. I did Andrew Luck number two, and I did a little homerism there. I guess you could say Matt Barkley number one. And my reason just behind that was, I mean, he had better numbers than Matt Leinart did and Carson Palmer did. And I think the way he had to do it this year, not being able to go to a bowl and just having so many things against him as far as the sanctions and all the NCAA stuff that we've talked about like a million times, I just felt that he was able to kind of step above all of that, and that's kind of why I put him in there. But maybe get your thoughts on how I voted for the Heisman.
Well, you know, it's definitely a valid vote. Matt's definitely a deserving guy. I think how you voted is kind of a reflection of what happens in the Heisman vote. And people always wonder, you know, how can you vote for this guy? How can you vote for that guy? But Matt Barkley's a guy you've been covering for 4 years now. You know him very well. And if you look at who you voted for, Matt Barkley, you know very well, and Andrew Luck, you probably know second most well among the candidates because you've seen him play three times. You've been pretty close to him. You've been at Pac-12 Media Day and all that stuff. And it's just kind of human nature to vote for something or to choose something or to adhere yourself to something that you know very closely. So it makes sense. You know, Matt Barkley's numbers were wonderful. You've been around him. You know he's a great guy. And you know, it's a very natural thing to vote for that which is familiar. So I think we'll see that all around the country where there's people who cover Alabama are voting for Trent Richardson, and people who cover Wisconsin are voting for Monty Ball, and so on and so forth. So I think it's a very good effort on your first try as a Heisman voter, and you can certainly do a lot worse.
All right. Well, thanks for that. Now, do you want to talk about who you voted for, or do you wait till after, or how does that work?
I'll tell you who I voted for. I actually voted for Andrew Luck first, and then I voted for Robert Griffin III second, and I voted for Monty Ball third. And my reasoning was I struggled a lot between Griffin and Luck, and I actually think Griffin's going to win the race. And I figured that if Griffin wins, I can say I voted for Luck, whereas if I had voted for Griffin and he had won, then I might have regretted not voting for Luck. So I kind of have it both ways in that regard. Kind of some convoluted thinking, I guess. But and then as for the third spot, Monty Ball, he had 38 touchdowns. And in the end, I couldn't let a guy who had scored 38 touchdowns not appear on a ballot. It just didn't seem right to me. And I struggled a lot with that third spot. I thought about Tyrann Mathieu of LSU. I thought about Colin Klein of Kansas State because I really was impressed by him and what he did with the Wildcats over there. Coming back into the top 10. So I ended up going with Monty Ball because of those 38 touchdowns. I don't think I could have gone wrong with either Andrew Luck or Robert Griffin III. But I chose Luck because, again, he's a guy I've talked to, I've met him, and he seemed like a really humble guy. And there's that personal connection that's hard to overcome.
I agree. And for Trent Richardson, I think that it seemed to me there was some kind of agenda pushing him. I mean, most of his yards came against the really crappy defenses, like half his yards came in like four games. And with Mathieu, I mean, he was suspended for a little while. I mean, it wasn't like a Charles Woodson kind of season for him, for me at least. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Yeah, you know, that was in the end. I wasn't going to vote for a guy who'd been suspended during the year. That was a decider for Matthew, especially. Richardson, I think he's a great back. I think he didn't have a great year. He had under 1,600 yards, and, you know, there's only been one other running back since 1975 who gained under 1,600 yards and won the Heisman, and that was his former teammate, Mark Ingram. So I wasn't about to give Richardson another, crack at that. And plus, they got the BCS title game, both teams in there. I think they don't need a Heisman. So that was my rationale behind not picking Trent Richardson. I'm happy with my vote. And I think in the end, it's going to be Robert Griffin III. I think he's going to win, not by a landslide, not by a huge amount, but somewhat comfortably.
I don't think that would be a bad thing for him. And you know, we'll see. I mean, I think he'd be a great candidate. I mean, he was awesome this year. So,
yeah.
There's a lot of deserving guys this year. I don't think it should be any kind of runaway winner. But I'll be curious to see what happens. But I guess the first thing is, who's going to be up there in New York? Did Matthew do enough to bump Barkley, I guess, as one of the top five guys? Is Barkley going to be there? What do you think?
Well, that's what a lot of SC people have asked me over the last few days, is Matt going to go? And unfortunately, I think there's a difference between saying someone should go and whether someone will go. And it's probably true of about eight or nine people that they should go to New York. I mean, you look at the list, Kellen Moore had probably his best season of four remarkable seasons. And he's not going to be anywhere near New York. And he went last year. Russell Wilson of Wisconsin had another fantastic year. Won't be anywhere near New York. It was a really strong field this year. And how they work it is, I often hear this other thing that people say, who are the five finalists going to be? Well, it's not five finalists. In the last 20 years, there's only been twice has there been five finalists in New York. Most of the time, it's three or four. And how they work it is they look at the at your support level. And if there's a big drop-off between three and four or a big drop-off between four and five, that person on the outer part of that tally doesn't go. That's where the cutoff is. And I think it's going to be four guys. I think it's going to be Robert Griffin. I think it's going to be Andrew Luck. I think it's going to be Trent Richardson. And I think it's going to be Monty Ball. Although, if anyone will be left off that, it will be Monty Ball. So I don't think Matt's going to make it this year. If he comes back, I think he's a lock to make it next year. And I would call him the Heisman frontrunner, especially given what I consider to be the greatest receiving corps in the history of college football coming back to throw to.
Wow. So, I mean, well, I guess those touchdowns kind of impress you, I guess.
What's that?
All the touchdowns impress you, huh?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that part of the huge reason for Matt's success was having the best receiving corps in the country to throw to, without a doubt.
Yeah, I mean, having his numbers be better than Palmer's, better than Leinert's. We'll talk about if Barkley comes back and all that stuff another day, but. I know Lane Kiffin.
The comparison with the numbers, the thing is it's kind of a different era now. And back when Carson Palmer had those numbers and Matt Leinart had those numbers, the spread era hadn't really, come upon us. And those kind of numbers now are par for the course. So to say they were better, I think, maybe that's not quite the angle I would have taken to convince people about Matt Barkley's worthiness. The problem with basing your campaign almost entirely upon statistics is that most statistics can be shot full of holes. So you can talk about Matt Barkley having more touchdown passes than Andrew Luck, but then you could also turn around and say, well, he also threw the ball 77 more times. And he had four more touchdown passes. So there's all kinds of ways to look at it, and I think there's a lot more reasons why Matt Barkley deserved to go to New York rather than just his stats alone.
Do you think David Shaw kind of screwed over Andrew Luck a little bit by not opening up more and letting him throw the ball more?
Well, I don't know who he was going to throw to. They had a former walk-on, Griff Whalen, as their primary receiver for much of the last half of the year, and I think if you look at the history of football, and you're looking at an offense that's based primarily on tight ends and just throwing to tight ends and maybe to some running backs out of the backfield, you don't see many guys throwing 35 touchdown passes and having that efficiency rating with those kind of targets to throw to. I certainly think that if, you know, I think Shaw was correct. He did not have two first-round picks to throw to. And so I think that kind of puts the context, you know, what Luck did this year. And I think the most impressive thing that I think the thing that impressed me the most, I was going to vote for Robert Griffin III, and what impressed me the most at the end was the presentation that Shaw made explaining how Luck calls 90% of the plays, basically serves as an offensive coordinator on the field. Makes you wonder, you know, what they're paying the other offensive coordinator for. But you know, I thought that was very impressive.
All right, so we're going to see. You think Robert Griffin is going to finish first? How do you have the order coming in your mind? How do you think it's going to come down?
I've got it nailed. I think it's going to be Robert Griffin, the third. Then it's going to be Andrew Luck. Then it's going to be Trent Richardson. Then it'll be Monty Ball. And then it'll be Tyrann Mathieu. And then it'll be Matt Barkley. I think that'll be the top six. And then seventh will be Case Keenum. There's a chance that 5, 6, and 7 could be slightly different, but I'm pretty solid on the top four. Based on my understanding of how the vote's going and my engaging of the various voters that I've talked to, that appears to be the way it's going right now.
I tried to do my best to watch as much football as I could this weekend because there was Heisman candidates all over the place, and got to see Keenum, man. I was thinking about him for a little while, and then he just – really the only time I got to see him extensively, he didn't play all that well.
Which guy?
Case Keenum.
Oh, Case Keenum, yeah. You know, that's another example of a guy that was in his position as a Heisman contender because of he was on an undefeated team and he had incredible stats, but not many people had actually seen him play, or not enough people had seen him play, in what amounted to a big game. So in the biggest game of their season, their conference title game, 9 o'clock start out west, national television, that was the first chance a lot of people got to really see him. And so they wanted to put kind of some actions to those stats, and actions and a face and a name to those stats they knew about and to those wins they had seen. And it turned out that he didn't have a great game, and that pretty much shot his candidacy full of holes. So I think it's, you know, that shows you the danger of the Heisman race and what can happen in just one game.
All right. Well, you're out there in New York now. What are you looking forward to doing? You're going to be there for a while.
Yeah, I decided to take a few more days this year. I'm here with one of the friends of the website, Lanny Julius, who I think will be on your podcast next week. We do this every year. We go out here. We cover the Heisman ceremony. We're going to be here when the players arrive. We'll get interviews. We'll have streaming video with some Heisman voters like Stu Mandel of Sports Illustrated. We will be having covering the press conference at the Heisman when the winner comes afterwards and has his press conference. We'll have exclusive coverage of that streaming live. We'll have quotes, pictures, all the kinds of things you'd expect covering an event like this. And on my website, there's sort of a Heisman Central page, just kind of like how you have your spring football central or fall camp central page for USCFootball.com. I've done the same thing. So we're going to be here and cover as much of the Heisman as we can and you know, try to get as much information out to as many people as possible.
All right. Well, Chris, we look forward to the Heisman ceremony and checking out what you got going on the site. Again, it's HeismanPundit.com. Thanks for joining us at the New York. Which airport are you at?
Well, we just left JFK. We're going through some fog that's as thick as pea soup. I think that's the soup that you always have to. It always has to be when it's thick. It's never any other kind of soup. It's always pea soup.
I don't know why that is, but.
Yeah.
Pea soup. Well, enjoy your time in New York. Tell Lanny I said hello, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Sounds great, Ryan. I'll talk to you later.
All right, everyone. That's Chris Houston, HeismanPundit.com. Check it out. As leading up to the Heisman ceremony this Saturday, we'll find out who wins the award. He's saying Robert Griffin III from Baylor. Thank you very much for tuning into the podcast this week. Thanks to Dan Weber for answering all the questions. And don't forget, we'll have a recruiting podcast tomorrow. And as Chris mentioned, we want to have Lanny Julius on, the Super Scout, next week, who always likes to break down USC's recruiting classes. We'll see what he had to say about the 2011 class. Did he think Marquise Lee was going to have a breakout year? We'll find all that stuff out next week when we talk to Lanny. Thanks again for tuning in to the podcast, and we'll talk to you all then.
You've been listening to the Peristyle Podcast presented by USCFootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. And don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your iPod or MP3 player for free. Just click the iTunes link on peristylepodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.